Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there, and while you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. All the articles, all the academies. You know, we publish a lot of books, and not just Chad's books. I mean, we publish Chad's books, of course, but, you know, there's other books too. So, obviously, if you've not read Chad's books, any, you know, you go buy all of them immediately. Maybe you've read Chad's books. There's other books that you could read. I've even written a book. I mean, shocking as it may seem, and you could even read that. Anyway, you can go to 1517.org, go to the bookstore, check out all the books that we've published. Chad, last episode, we had a need for some Levites. You know, we need some Levites. We got some stuff that needs to get carried. And if we could just get some guys that were designated and authorized to carry this stuff, we could get this show on the road. Well, we found some Levites, and we're going to get this show on the road. Maybe the king says to you, hey, how'd you like a little armed escort? You know, how'd you like a little, maybe you could... We can ensure safety on your way, but you've been talking, you know, talking your God up pretty big, and so you have to decline the armed escort and just really go with the armor of God and the fasting and praying. That's what you're gonna go with, and that's kind of where we ended. Where we got the distinct feeling that they would like to say yes to the armed escort, but feel like you really can't do that.
Yeah, and if you can't do that, well, then you're going to fast and you're going to pray and you're going to hope for the best. And as it turns out, as we hear in Ezra 8:24 and following, the hand of God was on them and they made the journey, that long journey, safely. So picking up there with Ezra 8:24, he says that he set apart 12 of the leading priests. Of course, 12. I mean, how many? You're going to go with the number 12. You have to. So 12 of these leading priests, and he puts in their hands all the silver and gold, the vessels, the offering for the house of our God and the king and his counselors. So he weighs this all out. We have the measurements there in verses 26 and following. So many talents of silver and so many talents of gold and the bowls and the bronze vessels. So he puts these in the hands of these designated dozen priests, and he says to them, "You are holy to the Lord, and the vessels are holy, and the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers." So this is, of course, Leviticus language talking about holy to the Lord. And as we talked about multiple times back, whenever that was, years ago when we covered Leviticus, holy doesn't have to do with morality. Holiness doesn't have to do with ethics. Holiness has to do with being in some way chosen and designated as holy by God, set apart for some specific kind of purpose and connected with the presence of holiness in the temple in Jerusalem. So the priests are holy, of course, because they're a part of that group of men who are set aside, who are declared holy by God so they can be in his holy space. And the vessels are holy. Of course, not just people are holy, but also time and space and things like these vessels. The vessels are holy because these have been designated for use in the holy space of the temple. So the priests are holy and the vessels are holy. And so these are going to be offerings to the Lord, the God of your father. So he tells them to guard them and to keep them until they are actually given to the hands of the chief priest and Levites and all the folks there in Jerusalem. So this is, of course, before they leave, all these preparations are being done. And, you know, it's not just a concern with sanctity, but I'm sure it's also a concern with just making sure these things don't fall into the wrong hands, right? It's a lot of money. It's a lot of silver and gold. So anytime that you're transporting something that's not only sacred, but also is of tremendous value, then you want to make sure that it's accounted for when you leave and accounted for when you get there.
It's the kind of stuff that makes you kind of wish you had like an armed escort. It's that kind of stuff. Matt, you know, you ever seen one of those, you know, like those vehicles? It's like, you know, stopping by a certain bank. They're loading up the things into this like bulletproof, you know, truck. You know, you see the little slots in the side. You know, there's a dude back there with a gun that he can like shoot out. You're like, yeah, see, that is what you call a deterrent. That's what this is called. Okay, so yeah. Now imagine that you just saw them loading up, you know, all the money from the bank into like the trunk of a Prius. I don't know if this is the same.
Not quite the same security there.
Not quite the same. And you know, and like you're saying, this is not this. You know, some of this stuff is, I mean, just valuable because it's money, essentially, right? I mean, it's precious metals. But a lot of this stuff too is like, this is not replaceable. These are not replaceable things. They can't just go back and unlock the storage unit and get some more stuff and replace it or something. Like, this is all of it.
Yeah. This would be, I mean, it's of course not an exact parallel, but you know, you have certain sacred things or expensive things at churches that you just can't get on Amazon and mm-hmm. purchase. I mean, I'm not saying you can't purchase those, but it's not like you can have it on your doorstep the next day. Cause of course these are special kinds of vessels, special kind of utensils that are used in the temple. So it's great value in more ways than one, sacred value as well as material value. So they get all this together, make sure they know who's going to be in charge of it, and then they leave. So verse 31 says they departed from the river Ahava. We talked about that, I think, in the last episode. This is both a designation, probably for a canal as well as the place where it was. So they leave, and they were supposed to leave around the first day of the first month, but it turns out they had that delay because of the Levite problem that you mentioned at the beginning. So they leave almost 2 weeks later, 12th day of the first month. They begin this long journey. And we're told that everything was good. They're fasting and they're praying paid off. God was with them. The hand of our God was on us, Ezra says. And he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes, by the way. I don't know if that means that there were actual ambushes and they were able to defend themselves, or if God just made sure there were no ambushes. Either way, whether these existed or whether they were prevented by the hand of God, they made it safely. No problems. Long journey. They finally get there to Jerusalem. And when they arrive, verse 32 says they remain there for 3 days. Probably just simply because they were, it was a long journey. It wasn't like you jumped in the car and then a few hours later, you're from Babylon to Jerusalem. A long journey. So some days for recovery, your stereotypical 3 days we find throughout the scriptures.
I was about to say, Chad, you and I both know why you got to rest for 3 days.
And we are recording this. People don't realize this, but this is Tuesday after Easter.
Yeah, we know. Right? We know about 3 days.
We've heard a lot about 3 days over the course of this week.
That's why I always that's why I always support 3 day weekends, Chad. It's very biblical.
Yeah, four. I mean, four is also a biblical number. 4 day weekends are also acceptable.
Yeah, I just like, you know, you need 3 days to rest before you get back to it.
You know, it is worth saying as sort of a footnote here to Ezra. I frequently get asked, especially leading up to Easter, you know, what's up with the 3 days? And Paul talks about Christ was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. And people will ask, well, where's that at in the Old Testament?
According to the scriptures. It was right here. Here's one.
Yeah, well, here's one. So we can get a whole list of references to either third day or after 3 days, where basically the 3 day period is a period of preparation or waiting for something big to happen. And often the big thing is something that God is doing for his people. So all you got to do is begin to search for third day or after 3 days. And you find that according to the scriptures, that is according to multiple instances in the Old Testament, that 3 day period is the, you can call it stereotypical, you can call it God ordained, whatever it is the standard period of time in which you wait for the resolution of something, God to do something, the big thing to happen. And of course, here it is after 3 days when they actually go to the temple, which of course was really, I mean, Jerusalem was the destiny, but if you really wanted to kind of pinpoint the actual destination, it's the house of God. And that's exactly where they end up here after 3 days of rest.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you'll have in the New Testament, it'll say, you know, as it is written, you know, quote some thing, Isaiah, Psalm, whatever it is. And then other times it'll just say, according to the scriptures, and you're like, where's the scripture? And it's just like, well, it's just according to the totality of scripture. It's like, that's what it is. It's like if I said to you, listen, the Bible says, makes it very clear that Jesus is God. According yes. to the scriptures, Jesus is God. And you say, where does it say that? I'm like, everywhere. It's like the Trinity. Where is it? It's everywhere. It's according to the scriptures, God is Trinity. Now, I can give you, obviously, point out the examples, but it's a way of even of saying something with more authority, not less, than quoting a single verse, where you're like, I don't know, where would you like me to start?
Yeah, and I think actually most of the time when just in common teaching in churches, when we're talking about whatever the topic might be, that is the way that we speak. I mean, rather than citing an individual verse, a lot of times we'll say, well, the scriptures teach blah, 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 whatever it is. And we can, yeah, it's not as if we can't pinpoint certain verses, but most of the time what's happening is you're taking parts from this verse and that verse and allusions to another verse, and you're putting together in a cohesive sort of way that is kind of a summarizing of the teaching of the scriptures in various places. Yeah. So anyway, that's the all application of the 3 days. So on the fourth day, within the house of our God, the silver and the gold and the vessels were weighed into the hands of Meremoth the priest, son of Uriah, and with him was Eleazar the son of Phinehas, and with them were the Levites. The whole was counted and weighed, and the weight of everything was recorded. So basically, they took all the things that had been gathered in Babylon, and they then took it into the house of God and made sure that everything was actually there that had been given to them. So the journey was a long journey, not only for the people, but also for all the things that they had. And now they're being delivered into the hands of those who will be using them for the service of God's house. And then wrapping up the chapter, this is 35 and 36. At that time, those who had come from captivity, the returned exiles, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel. 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, as a sin offering, 12 male goats. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord. And they also delivered the king's commissions to the king's satraps and to the governors of the province beyond the river, and they aided the people and the house of God. And I wish that's where the book of Ezra stopped, quite honestly, because we've got some uncomfortable territory to get into in Ezra 9 and 10. This would have been a much more kind of positive ending to the book of Ezra, but it's not the ending. I mean, it is a great ending to that chapter because, I mean, you have the preparation, you have the authorization, you have the gathering of Levites, you have the gathering of these gold and silver and bronze vessels, and then you have the long and arduous journey and dangerous journey, which was successful and safe. And then they get there, and then you have the 3 days of rest. And then you have this fourth day where everything reaches its goal. Not only do they deliver all the things to the house of God, but they have worship, which is centered upon burnt offerings and sin offerings. So all of these kinds of emblems of the sacrifice that is to come in the sacrifice of Christ. And so it's great. It's wonderful gospel news, because all of this is a prefigurement of Christ. Everything from the house of God, Jesus says that his body is our new temple, to the sacrifices, where he is the sacrifice to end all sacrifices, to the priesthood, where he is the priest, our great high priest who takes us into the presence of his Father. So all of this is good news. All of this is great. And this would be a wonderful way to kind of put an exclamation point on it and then move on to Nehemiah.
Imagine you're like in some kind of Bible reading plan. And yeah, you know, you read Ezra 8, and you're like, wow, that's really just great. It seems like, you know, God was really faithful, and man, these people were in captivity, but now they're out, and they're rebuilding the temple, and man, everything, he's taking care of them, his hands on them, it's just great. So you close the book, and you know, I just can't wait to get to chapter 9, see what is in store tomorrow.
You know, more good things are coming.
Yeah, so you gotta wake up the next morning, and you crack the book open, and you're ready to get into Ezra chapter 9 and find out, you know, let's check in on the people and see how it's going. And I got to tell you, I don't know if you had never read the Bible, I don't know if anything could prepare you. Like, you might think, like, whoa, maybe it's going to get bad. You know, there's going to be some idols introduced or whatever. That would be fair enough. You'd be like, yeah, that would be consistent with it. I don't think if I gave you 15 guesses, you would go with what we see in chapter 9.
No, I don't think. And in fact, it's unprecedented. There's nothing really that prepares us for what is coming here, because like you said, we've seen idolatry. We've seen rebellion. We've seen all sorts of bad things happening in Israel. What we haven't seen is what's going to come up here as not only the issue that is being faced by Israel, and not only the way it's resolved, so not only the issue and not only the resolution, but also different here is the way in which we're going to see the scriptures interpreted and applied to this situation.
Yeah, this is where you know you're dealing with like real people, and like it's just telling you how it went down, because you can wrap your head around the situation. Like the situation makes total sense. You're like, yeah, of course. The solution and how you get to that solution is so human, because you're like, ooh, I don't know. Do I agree that this is what you should do? And I think that maybe sometimes you read the Bible. I mean, we're like, cart's like way out in front of the horse here, but there are times in narratives like this where it is okay to ask the question, is that like, unless you have a thus saith the Lord, like, is this the right way to do this? Is that the right, are they interpreting the scripture rightly and then applying it rightly? What's happening here?
It's a wonderful example, as you were just saying, where it's necessary, not only helpful, but very necessary. And we have this in many narratives in scripture. Where you have to ask yourself, okay, is this descriptive or prescriptive?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the things that are described in choose your narrative, you know, David, an old man in bed and he can't stay warm. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to find him the beautiful young virgin to keep him warm in bed. Is that prescriptive or descriptive?
Yeah.
Well, that's obviously, I hope everyone would agree, is descriptive. It's not saying that, hey, you know, if you got a, got an aged politician who can't stay warm, that you need to make sure you get him a young, beautiful virgin to keep him warm in bed. No, this is just a description of what happened. It's not saying that it should have happened or should not have happened. It's just simply saying, hey, that's what went down. Same thing is going to happen here in Ezra 9:9-10. Now, we might have some listeners who disagree with us, and that's fine. I will say this, and I know, like you said, we have the cart way in front of the horse here. But I found it very interesting. This morning, I read, I don't know, I think four different commentaries on these chapters. And three of them use the almost exact expression to describe the resolution to what happens. They all said, well, really what happened was Ezra chose the lesser of two evils.
Mm.
Now, isn't that, I was like, whoa, that other commentator said that. I read the third one. Oh, two more commentators said that. Becomes a theme. Well, to point out the obvious, when you choose the lesser of two evils, you still choose an evil.
Yeah.
So
that's how it happens. Every election that happens, they're like, "Dang, I got to choose the lesser of two evils." And you're like, I don't like being in this situation of choosing evil.
Yeah, not a good place for us to be. So, okay, I know. If you don't know what Ezra 9 and 10 are about, you've all been just waiting for us to get there. So let me just kind of give you the big picture, first of all, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty. The big picture, the problem is this. Ezra discovers that there's been marriages that have been contracted and fulfilled. So marriages between Israelite men and non-Israelite women. So intermarriage or marriage outside of the people group, whatever you want to call it. So that's the issue. And we'll, like I said, we'll get to the details in a minute, but that's going to be the problem that is confronting them. You got Israelite men from all levels, so from the people of the land, from the priests, from the Levites, so clergy, laity, everybody's done this. I mean, not everybody, but some people within all these different groups have done this. These men have married women who are outside of the Israelite family. So that's the issue. And then over the course of prayer and confession and biblical interpretation and kind of back and forth, what they decide to do, and we'll hear about this in Ezra 10 especially, is that these men will divorce the wives that they have married and send them away along with any children that have been the fruit of that marriage. So that ought to be enough to kind of give you a heads up as the problem and the kind of the discussion of how to resolve it, and then the resolution that they came to.
Yeah. So it seems that they have a different interpretation of Scripture than Paul does. They're coming to different solutions here for the unbelieving spouse. This is a different approach. We could say that.
Yeah, it definitely is. So Paul encourages the not encourages, but tells the believer to stay. So if you're married to an unbeliever, which, you know, it's a parallel situation here. Maybe not even, you know, a strict parallel, because we're never told that these non-Israelite women who married Israelite men weren't believers in Yahweh.
Yeah.
These might have been people who had, women who had actually had become part of the faith of Israel.
Oh, well, in this day, if you're a woman and you married a guy, you do probably marry into his religion.
Yeah, most of the time that's what would have happened. So that's enough of kind of the big picture. Let's get into the details. Ezra 9 begins with a timestamp here. It says after these things had been done. So that's vague, but we know from details in the rest of Ezra 9 and 10 that about 4 months have passed. So they get there in the fifth month, which we just heard about. And all these events are going to happen in the ninth month. So we've got a few months that have gone by. Ezra's been in town. I'm sure he's kind of getting the lay of the land, getting to know what's been going on in Jerusalem, get to know the leadership, whatnot. So whether he had heard rumors about this or was unaware, we really don't know. But anyway, it says after these things had been done, the officials approached me, Ezra says. So this is first person. Whoever the officials are, these leaders, they approach Ezra, and they have a report that they think that he needs to know. And here's what they said. The people of Israel and the priest and the Levites. So there's your three groups that I mentioned earlier. So not just the leadership, not just the laity, but people from all these various groups, trifold way of distinguishing the people of Israel that we encounter in most of this post-exilic literature. What have they done? Well, it's not what they've done, it's what they've not done. They have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. Let me just read a little bit farther, then we'll talk about a lot of stuff here. For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race, now literally in Hebrew that is the holy seed, the holy race or the holy seed, has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithlessness, now, that is a loaded Hebrew word. We'll come back to that too. But ma'al is the Hebrew there. Could be like it's a violation against sanctity, basically. So in this violation against sanctity, the hand of the officials and chief men have been foremost, end quote. So this is the report that's given to Ezra. So what's going on here? Well, first of all, the language of separating yourselves from the peoples of the lands, that's pretty typical Torah language. We hear this kind of verbiage a lot of different times in a lot of different ways. So the Hebrew verb for separate is badal. It occurs already in Genesis 1, where God separates this from that in the elements of creation. And then he tells it is his people, they are to separate themselves from the peoples of the land. They're to separate themselves from unclean foods. So badal, to separate or to distinguish, is a very common word throughout the Torah. So no surprise there that Israel, in various facets of its life, was to separate itself from that which was unclean. All right, so far, so good. So they haven't separated themselves, though, from the peoples of the lands with their abominations. All right, well, who are these peoples of the lands? Well, here's where we already are running into problems here. Because the list is the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, which is a strange inclusion in this list, and the Amorites. Well, what's the problem here? Well, a major part of the problem is at least two, if not three, of these people groups are no longer in existence. So that's a major problem here. Well, it's a problem in only on the surface. Okay, here's what I think is happening. The report is, okay, you don't have this separation. You got men from various parts of Israel, and they are marrying the women from the current peoples of the land. And, you know, we know this was kind of a mixed group because these were brought in primarily by the Assyrians after the Northern Kingdom was destroyed. And they're called by names that are lifted from the Torah of people groups that used to be, you know, all those ites that we talked about when we covered Deuteronomy and Joshua, the Perizzites, Jebusites, the Hivites, all the ites. So kind of the way I read this, they haven't separated themselves from the peoples of the land with their abominations from the, quote, Canaanites, Hittites, so on and so forth. It's as if the current peoples of the lands are being called by the names of the former inhabitants of the land so as to link that former uncleanness of those peoples with whom Israel was not to marry with the current peoples who are there. And they threw in there also the Egyptians for some reason, even though the Egyptians are never, not once included in the list of the peoples with whom Israel was not to intermarry back in the days of the Torah.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, so if you're trying to make an argument here that got something really bad going on, you got this intermarrying thing going on, and you use sort of the old school names, which is linked to some old school idolatry, which got you in a bunch of trouble. What's happening here is they're like, look, okay, so the holy race, or like the Hebrew seed, or whatever you want to say it is, you take this all the way back to like Solomon did this, and that didn't work out good, and all kinds of people did this after that, didn't work out good. And by going down this list, you're sort of pulling on the, if you're a guy in the know, which these leaders are, you're pulling on the historical threads there, right? Where you're like, you know, like the Perizzites, you know, like the Canaanites, you know, like all these ites, you know how this went down, you know where this ends. We just got our house in order, and look at this. I mean, so I guess to start with, I'll say I am sympathetic to the concern, because historically this hasn't worked out well.
Yes, yeah, I'm with you on that, and that is a good positive thing to emphasize here, that I think the motivation here, the desire on their part not to repeat the mistakes of their forefathers, is a great thing. I mean, that should be kind of where all of us are, right? If we look back on a previous generation of Christians, let's say, who did some really terrible things that had some terrible results, then we can say to ourselves, well, I'm certainly not going to go down that road. I'm not going to do that. Look at how it devastated the church, or look at all the problems that it created for the church. Well, then certainly let's reform. Let's not repeat those mistakes of the past. And that's kind of where these people are. I mean, they feel like, as you say, they've barely got their feet on the ground. They're wanting to make sure they don't slip into the idolatry of their forefathers. So there's sort of a super diligence that's going on here. That is driving them to confront this issue. Now, I do want to just to clarify things as far as what the scriptures taught, what the Torah taught, especially about intermarriage. So if you're an Israelite man, you are not prohibited from marrying outside of Israel. I mean, there are certain non-Israelite women that you can marry. There are no biblical prohibitions against that. However, there were prohibitions against marrying some, and the ones that you were prohibited from marrying were those who were those indigenous inhabitants of Canaan. Some of those that are listed here, right? The Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Amorites. So on the one hand, we have intermarriage with Israelite men and non-Israelite women permitted, but we also have prohibited Israelite men from marrying certain parts of these people groups that, remember, were to be completely destroyed from the Holy Land. All right. So you got some allowed, some forbidden. Now, to kind of confuse things even further, you also have instances in the scriptures, and we've talked about these, where prominent leaders married, prominent Israelite leaders married women who were not part of Israel. I mean, you think Joseph married an Egyptian wife back in the book of Genesis. Moses married a Midianite wife. And then, I mean, the most glaring example of all is Ruth. Ruth is from Moab. She ends up marrying Boaz, who is, of course, Ruth and Boaz, they're part of the Davidic line. So you have certain marriages prohibited, you have certain marriages allowed, and then you even have some marriages that kind of shed light on the fact that just because a woman was from one of these indigenous peoples does not mean that she's necessarily going to lead an Israelite man astray. And then you also have plenty of cases such as Solomon's, where he married women from all these neighboring nations, and they actually did lead his heart astray. All that to say, it's not as kind of a black and white an issue as some people might think that it is. I mean, you have clear prohibitions, you have clear allowances, and then you got examples of some men who married non-Israelite women where it worked out great. Ruth, for instance. And then you have examples where Israelite men married non-Israelite women, and it worked out terribly, as in the case of Solomon.
Yeah, it seems like there's one of two ways that you could look at this, or there could be two options of what's freaking them out. One is that the mistakes of the forefathers, we don't want to repeat those. I mean, we were just in captivity and whatnot. We're not, and that's how we got there, is or this at least played a part in that. So we don't want to do that. That's commendable. To not want to do that. If it's, hey, we got to keep this, you know, this holy Hebrew seed pure, yeah, that ship sailed. So yeah. You just forget about that. Like, I mean, that's over. And like, not something, I mean, you go read the genealogy of Jesus and you'll know that this is you can forget about that long before this.
Yeah. And that actually, that is my biggest issue with what happens here. So if you go back to the prohibitions against marrying certain women from certain groups, the reason is always the same. The reason is always because these women, say it's a Canaanite woman. Okay, she was raised worshiping Baal, let's say, or Asherah, whoever. The reason is always that, well, if a man, Israelite man, marries her, then there's a chance that she's going to lead his heart astray, so he begins to worship these other gods. And of course, we have examples where that it was legitimate fear. This did happen, all right? But what we never have in the Torah is a concern that the, quote, holy race or holy seed of Israel is going to be somehow contaminated by non-Israelite blood.
Right.
So the reason they're giving here, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands, is an illegitimate not unwarranted interpretation of the scriptures.
Yep.
So it's not the Torah does not give that as a reason. So if that is if that's their motivating reason, which I mean we have it right here in the book of Ezra that was their reason, then it is a what should we call it? It's what the Jews would call a legal midrash. It's an interpretation of legal material. An application to change circumstances that, in my opinion, is not warranted by the Torah.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I mean, this is just me taking note, again, according to the scriptures, totality of scriptures here. I just don't think that God views the Jews as a race in that way. When we think about race, and you like, if you're checking some box on an application or something like that, and it's like, you know, white, Black, Hispanic, other, you know, Native American, whatever. It's not like that. Like, these people are all in the same part of the world. They probably all look the same. They're not. It's not races like that. Like, the Jews aren't a certain race. It's a people group, and this is how God addresses them as a group of people. The same way that the church is a people group. That Christians are a people group that can be comprised of many races. Like, this is not the issue. I don't think God ever had this issue with people who didn't come from Abraham becoming part of the people group. That's, we know that he doesn't have an issue with that.
Right. Yeah. We have like whole biblical books
that
are named after a woman who came from outside Israel. And she didn't, you know, pollute the seed of Israel by marrying Boaz.
No, it's not a race in that way.
Right. Yes. And so I think, like we said just a few minutes ago, we can understand where these people are coming from. They're really circling the wagons here. They're circling the wagons here. They're building walls. They're digging moats. I mean, they're going all out here to make sure that the holy seed of Israel is going to be protected from, you know, making the same mistakes that generations before them made. However, the biblical justification that they're using for this is not is just simply not warranted by the law. If they'd have said, you know, we're afraid these non-Israelite women are going to lead our Israelite men astray, well, that would have been at least in keeping with what the scriptures have said. And then just to kind of say one more thing here about verse 2, and it's the Hebrew word that I quoted earlier, ma'al, which is translated here in the ESV as faithlessness. And in this ma'al, in this faithlessness, the hand of the officials and the chief men have been foremost. So the leadership is primarily the ones who've been engaged in the marriage of these non-Israelite women. Now, ma'al is a word that we have, especially in the Torah, and it's like if you violate some kind of sacred object, and this isn't like a sin of the high hand. It's not like you mean to. It's an unwitting error where you engage in some action where you violate something which is sacred. Then what you have to do is you offer not a burnt offering, not a sin offering, but a what's sometimes called a guilt offering or a reparation offering, where there is an offering of an animal, but also you add to that 20%. So it's a special kind of, one of the special kinds of offerings. And as we'll hear in chapter 10, that's precisely what these people do. So the idea is that we're a holy seed. We're a holy race, or whatever you want to call it. And by bringing these non-Israelite women in, we violated the holy seed in this unwitting sort of way and committed a sin then against that which is sacred. And so as a result, we are going to have to offer these reparation offerings, which is what they do, and which is what they do in chapter 10. Now, if they had just done that, I guess it would have been okay. But what they do is they go even beyond that. Not only do they offer a guilt offering because they have violated the holy seed, but the women and the children from the marriage, they are going to divorce and send away. Divorce and send away where? With what provisions? We're not told. They're just basically forced to leave the community. So, I mean, that we didn't get very far into chapter 9, but I think all of that was a necessary discussion, introduction to everything that's going to follow. We're going to see how Ezra reacts. We're going to see kind of the way that they are going to address the situation and deal with the situation in the rest of chapter 9 and chapter 10. But anyway, hopefully that will give you some food for thought as you think about the way they're kind of interpreting their own situation and then using the scriptures, the interpretation of the scriptures to apply it to what they're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Next episode, we will get to see Ezra's reaction, how he takes this news, and he does not take it well.
No, that was, to put it mildly. Yeah. We got pulling out of hair. We got ripping of clothes. We got praying and fasting and confessing. It's quite the reaction.
Yeah. Yes. All right. Well, we will get in there starting in verse 3 next week. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.